Let me begin by introducing myself. My name is Bruce Burt, and I teach Old Testament at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. I'm a United Methodist in the midst of most of you Lutherans. And I'll be doing Bible study for this entire week, Monday through Saturday, on the topic, Singing the Lord's Song, Isaiah 40 to 55. I thought I would begin by giving you a bit of an overview of the topics for the week so you have some kind of a roadmap of where we're going. I always find that useful. We're going to be focusing on the prophet whose material is in the 40th to the 55th chapter of the book of Isaiah. Because this prophet probably did his preaching or the writing of these oracles against the background of Israel's experience in the Babylonian exile. And I'm very interested this week in doing our Bible study with some careful attention to the importance of that background and what that might mean for our own understanding as the church in modern times. So for today's session, I want to focus the entire session on the setting of this prophetic material in the Babylonian exile and help us to understand the nature of that experience of Israel. And we'll be looking at some of the reflections of that experience in the prophetic material itself. But we'll also be looking at a few other places where we find things about the Babylonian exile, particularly the book of Lamentations, a couple of the Psalms that come from the Babylonian experience. I think you're all probably familiar with the one which begins by the waters of Babylon. We'll look briefly at that one. And a little bit at the prophet Jeremiah, whose preaching covered the same period of the events which led to the destruction of Jerusalem and the carrying away into exile. So all of those materials will help give us some resources for this session on the exile experience itself, as well as materials in Isaiah 40 to 55. As we'll see a little bit later, my concern then is that Isaiah 40 to 55 is a particular resource for helping communities to deal with exile-like experiences. So in the next five sessions after today, we're going to be looking at various themes within the book, within the 40th to the 55th chapter of Isaiah, for clues on how we might be a community able to sing the Lord's song in a strange land, in whatever strange land might lie ahead of us. And so for today, the title of the session is Exile and Judgment, but the titles for the next five sessions are The Foundations of Hope, God's Salvation, God's Creation, God's History, and The Servant of the Lord. And each of those sessions deals with a theme from the preaching of this prophet of the exile that we'll be calling Second Isaiah. Now, usually when you start a biblical study, particularly of one of the prophets in the Old Testament, you would start by talking about biographical information on the prophet, what we know about the prophet's life and the events in which the prophet was involved. But in this case, we have nothing of that sort to go on. This prophet is anonymous. We don't even know the name of this prophet. The most striking thing, in some ways, about this prophetic material is that the prophet has submerged his entire person to the message that he has to bring. The message is so much more important than anything personal or biographical about the prophet that none of that material is preserved or passed on to us. We get occasional hints. There's a little section in the start of chapter 40 that may give us a hint about the prophet's call, and we'll look at that tomorrow. But by and large, we don't learn anything about the prophet personally. We do get some reflections about the setting in which the prophet is working, and that setting is the period of the Babylonian exile. We see glimpses of that exile experience in the prophetic oracle. By the way, an oracle is simply a poetic fragment of preaching, a self-contained and formal piece of prophetic preaching. It's not intended to mean anything mysterious or like the oracle at Delphi or anything of that sort. It's simply the term we use to describe the poetic units of prophetic speech. But the prophetic oracles often give a hint of the historical setting in which the prophet speaks. In fact, Cyrus, the great Persian king, is mentioned by name twice, which gives us a very definite historical peg to hang things on. And southern kingdom of Judah is being talked about here, because the period of time we're dealing with is after the northern kingdom has already passed away. They fell at the hands of the Assyrians in 721. Now, because this historical setting in exile is so important, I want to begin with a kind of a historical background to familiarize us with the events leading up to and even through the experience of Israel in Babylonian exile. Now, this will be a bit complex at times and involve some difficult names of kings and empires and that sort of thing. So if at any point I lose anyone, I hope you'll interrupt me right there and say, wait a minute, I lost that, let me get that clear, and I'll try to clarify that. But it is very important that we understand this historical background, because it's the backdrop for all of the rest of the prophet's message, and so I want to begin there. It is a very interesting set of events. It's quite a dramatic story when you begin to unravel it. You can find some parts of the story told in a rather straightforward fashion in the final chapters of the book of 2 Kings. Other things we know about this period are found in the narrative material in the book of Jeremiah. And then for the period during and after the exile, we rely on the books of Lamentations and on the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. So I'm going to draw kind of a picture of this historical setting drawn from all of those biblical sources. A book I particularly recommend to you is called Israel in Exile by Ralph Klein, which is an excellent treatment of the whole period of exile and the literature which came out of it reacting to that experience. Well, you will notice on the board behind me, I have already displayed to you my unusual artistic talent. Along with being a teacher of Bible studies, it's a special bonus you get. Not finding any other maps around, I drew a map of the ancient Near East. I'm sure it was immediately apparent that that's what this was. You will recognize the Nile River over here. There's a pyramid right down here. Some of you in the back may not be able to see that. This is the Turkish Peninsula, Asia Minor. This is the Mediterranean Sea. Over here is the Dead Sea, the Jordan River, and the Sea of Galilee. And this little postage stamp area, actually, this is even for this scale of map, I've drawn this a little larger size. If I really drew it more to scale of the size of the kingdom of Judah and the whole of the ancient Near East, none of you in the room would even be able to see it. We would all be looking down here like this. And it's important to realize what a tiny little postage stamp kingdom Judah really was. And that helps us to understand the character of some of these events that are coming up. But this little area really is down here opposite the Dead Sea.
Jerusalem is almost even with the top of the Dead Sea, right over in here. And this little area right here opposite the Dead Sea is the kingdom of Judah. Now, these two rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. This is the Persian Gulf. And there's desert in the middle here, the great river valleys, where the areas of some of the great civilizations of the ancient Near East. There are mountains over here on this side of the river valleys, and on the other side of the mountains is Persia. Now I'll put some of those I'll put names to some of those things as we come to them. Well, in the closing years of the 7th century B.C., the southern Israelite kingdom of Judah was helplessly caught up in the political events of its time. Judah was only a tiny kingdom tossed on a turbulent sea of great power struggles between the kingdoms of that ancient time. The principal actors in this power struggle are the Assyrian Empire, which has the upper hand at the opening of our drama. Assyria is located in the top half of the Mesopotamian River Valley. So this area up here is Assyria. But the Assyrian Empire included everything you see on this map except the Egyptian territory along the Nile. So all of the Syro-Palestinian coast, a large portion of the Turkish peninsula, and all of the Mesopotamian River Valley was controlled by Assyria. But Assyria, in this particular period of time, toward the end of the 7th century B.C., was beginning to stumble. The empire was weakening, and it was starting to crumble around the edges. And so these events are taking place in a period of rapid political change. What's happening as Assyria weakens is that two other powers, seeing her weakness, try to seize the opportunity. One of those is Babylon, which is the southern portion of the Mesopotamian River Valley. And the other are the Medes, who are up here, kind of on the other side of the mountains to the north. Here are the mountains that go on here. And they, in effect, have Assyria. Babylon has been under Assyria's thumb and simply wants her independence, that she would take a good portion of the Assyrian Empire with her independence that she could get it. So Assyria is caught in a kind of a pincers between the Medes coming around the mountains to the north and the Babylonians asserting themselves from the south. The Medes eventually take a good portion of this area of Asia Minor to put over here. And Babylon, of course, takes her own territory back. Eventually, Assyria falls. It's not necessary to go into great detail about those events, but the city of Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria, falls in 612 B.C., and that's the final collapse of the great Assyrian Empire. Babylon then lays claim to the whole Mesopotamian River Valley and begins the period that we call the Neo-Babylonian Empire, because there was an earlier Babylonian Empire. This is the new Babylonian Empire. They're sometimes also in the Old Testament called the Chaldeans, because that's the name of a particular dynasty that was in control of Babylon at that time. But Babylonians and Chaldeans are the same thing in this period of history. One of the things that happened toward the end is that Assyria, looking for help from any quarter, appealed to Egypt for help. And so Egypt, seeing an opportunity to get a little more territory for herself, came to Assyria's aid and didn't arrive in time. I've always wondered if she did that intentionally. There's some debate among historians about that. Didn't manage to arrive in time to help Assyria, but her army did get all the way up here, and so not arriving in time to help Assyria, there's nothing left to do but just take all this territory for itself. So Egypt ends up with a big chunk of new territory too, which includes Judah. And so, as a result of these great power struggles, Judah, which was under the thumb of the Assyrian Empire, now has an Egyptian overlord. And the Egyptians install their own puppet king there. They choose the member of the royal household that they want to be king, because the king of Judah happened to be killed in a battle during this period. So the Egyptians said, well, the person we want on the throne is Jehoiakim. And so that's the king of Judah during this period. Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim is first a vassal king of Egypt, but it wasn't long before Babylon and Egypt clashed, and Babylon defeats Egypt and drives them back into their own territory, and Jehoiakim simply switches and becomes a Babylonian vassal king then. He knows what side his bread is buttered on. He was a particularly vain and greedy king. Jeremiah preached a lot of his oracles against Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim had the illusion that somehow out of all of these turbulent events, Judah was going to come back to a period of her former greatness. It seems kind of foolish when we really look at this scene in these ancient times to think of this tiny kingdom coming back to a golden age of international prominence. But that's what many of the people, including Jehoiakim, felt at the time. So at about 3 years after all of this took place, around 598, Jehoiakim decided the time had come and he withheld tribute from Babylon. And I don't know what he expected, but what I would expect happened. A Babylonian army appeared on the horizon and laid siege to Jerusalem. And Jehoiakim, not liking what was going on, died. And his teenage son came to the throne. I've always felt sorry for this poor boy. His name is very similar, but C-H-I-N on the end. He came to the throne during the siege. He wisely, in light of superior Babylonian strength, surrendered the city after a siege of 2 months. And the young king was taken as a prisoner to Babylon, where he was treated with some respect as a royal captive, and Jerusalem was spared. Jerusalem was not destroyed at this point. But along with Jehoiakim were taken into captivity members of the royal household, military officials, skilled craftsmen, bureaucrats, all of the most important people of the kingdom. And the temple was looted, and a number of its priests were taken captive. And just as a footnote here, one of the priests taken captive was the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a priest of the temple and had his call to be a prophet in exile in Babylon. Well, this is called the first exile in 597. Well, the young king of Babylon at this time was Nebuchadnezzar. And he's destined to be one of the great kings of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar dealt rather gently with Judah and allowed a new king to come to the throne and said, well, I hope you'll do better next time. Jehoiakim was an evil and greedy ruler. Nebuchadnezzar was willing to be understanding. The new king that came to the throne was named Zedekiah. There are a lot of oracles about Zedekiah in the book of Jeremiah, too. Now, Zedekiah was, in many respects, a better king than Jehoiakim, but he was a weak king. He vacillated back and forth, and he sometimes sought the prophet Jeremiah for advice, but more often he listened to those who said, we are God's people. God will surely vindicate us. The exiles will be brought back. The Babylonians will be punished. We'll be restored to the day of greatness of David and Solomon. This is our destiny. And Jeremiah had many conflicts with prophets who were preaching that false message of optimism. He had a word for them. They were those who cried peace, peace, when there was no peace. Well, Zedekiah finally gave in to the urging of those who urged him to confront Babylon so that the Lord could show he was truly on their side and restore their days of greatness. So Zedekiah eventually participated in a revolt against Babylonian rule in 588. And 1 year later, the Babylonian army under Nebuchadnezzar returned, and Nebuchadnezzar levels the city walls, destroys the temple. He blinds Zedekiah and takes him into captivity. And he carries off into exile virtually every citizen of any substance in the kingdom, leaving only the rural peasantry in the land. And the prophet Jeremiah, by the way, who was known to have urged Jerusalem to surrender and Zedekiah to turn back from that. Jeremiah was left in the land by the Babylonians because they knew of his policy. But I hope you all realize that Jeremiah was widely regarded then by his own people as a traitor. Well, in any case, this is the most devastating event of Israel's entire history. The capital, the temple, the kingship, their entire culture are in ruin. And virtually everyone of substance is carried away into exile, into second exile. Now, the destruction and suffering experienced by the people in these events is especially reflected in the Book of Lamentations. You really want to get an idea of the depth of suffering and despair in this experience. This is not, you know, we live in such a mobile age that sometimes we think, well, a change of location would be good for a change. This was not just being transferred by the company to Babylon. This was a total uprooting and overturning of everything that Israel looked to for meaning and value in her life. And you can get a sense of that by reading the little Book of Lamentations. It's only five chapters long. It's very depressing. You better read it on one of your good days. I'll give you a brief sample from chapter 1. Just let me read a little segment of Lamentations. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become, she that was great among the nations. She that was a princess among the cities has become a vassal. She weeps bitterly in the night, tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the appointed feast. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan. Her maidens have been dragged away, and she herself suffers bitterly. A little later in the same chapter, all her people groan as they search for bread. They trade their treasures for food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, and behold, for I am despised. Bitter, bitter poem. Things were a little bit better in Babylon, actually, than in the ruined city left behind, because the people in Babylon, the exiles in Babylon, were allowed to live together in a community there. The community, by the way, was named Tel Aviv, which is the name for the modern city in Israel. But you shouldn't... And they were able to pursue... some of their normal occupations and livelihood there, but you shouldn't let that mislead you. These were people deeply in despair because everything that they had held dear was overturned. They didn't know what to make of this set of circumstances. All that they had believed in now seems to have betrayed them. And there's great despair in the midst of that experience. Probably the best reflection of that is the experience in Babylon itself is the 137th Psalm. I want to read that to you. This is a this is a psalm that, I haven't had a chance to look in the Lutheran Book of Worship, but in a lot of the printing of Psalters and various church books of worship, they leave off the last two verses of this psalm because they're just too harsh to ever read in public worship. Starts out, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?" And then comes a vow. "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy." And then comes a curse. "Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, raise it down to its foundation. O daughter of Babylon, you devastator, happy shall he be who requites you with what you have done to us. Happy shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against a rock." You can probably see why we don't read that in public worship. The whole psalm is left out. Oh, well, that's even sadder. That's too bad. This is one of the great psalms. By the way, for those of you who are going to be around next week, I'm going to do a course on the psalms next week. But this is one of the great psalms. One of the things you have to remember is that one of the part of the genius of Hebrew worship was that they offered everything to God. Even their feelings of anger and vengeance were offered up to God, which is a lot better than taking it into one's own hands. When worship becomes only a putting on of the best faith, then how can we bring to the Lord those things that are most difficult for us to deal with? So there's a real reason for this being in the Psalter. It's to tell us that even those feelings of anger and vengeance are to be offered up to the Lord and not kept to one's own counsel. But that's to the side right now. But this certainly gives you some sense of the mood in Babylon, too. For they weren't suffering the physical difficulties of the community left in Jerusalem, but that they were in great despair. And in the midst of this exilic situation. Now, the prophet that we call 2nd Isaiah reflects this situation of exile. His prophetic work is probably some years after the exile has started, but nevertheless reflects this experience. For instance, chapter 42, verse 22. "This is a people robbed and plundered. They are all of them trapped in holes and hidden in prisons. They have become a prey with none to rescue, a spoil with none to say, restore." Or chapter 51, verse 17-20. "Rouse yourself, rouse yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl of staggering. There is none to guide her among all the sons she has borne. There is none to take her by the hand among all the sons she has brought up. These two things have befallen you. Who will condole with you?" And the two things are devastation and destruction, famine and sword. Who will comfort you? Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of every street like an antelope in a net. They are full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of your God. Now, the prophet 2nd Isaiah not only knows this past experience of exile, his memory is, these events are fresh in his memory, but he is also a prophet who sees, who looks to the future, who has a vision of the future. And the future is also reflected in the prophet's preaching. In chapters 40-55, looming on the horizon are a whole new set of events. which are going to involve Israel. Because the Persian king Cyrus has begun to stir over to the east. Over here on the other side of the mountain is Persia. And a young Persian prince named Cyrus has begun to consolidate all of the minor kingdoms that made up Persia. He very quickly wins a victory over the Medes and gains control of all of the territory of the Medes. He wins another victory and gains control of all of the Turkish peninsula. And before very long, it's right about at that point that I think our prophet begins to speak of Cyrus and look to Cyrus for some hope for the future return of the exile. We'll be talking about that in greater detail later. But Cyrus eventually, just to let you know where the story goes, eventually in 539, Babylon itself falls to Cyrus's army. Actually, Babylon's ruled by a very unpopular king, and the people preferred Cyrus. Cyrus is known for his great tolerance as a ruler. That was one reason there was hope for a return back to Jerusalem. And he preferred to let each of the areas of his kingdom follow their own religion, so there was hope for the rebuilding of the temple. So Cyrus was a hopeful figure, but a strange one, since he was a pagan king. I mean, imagine the deliverer being a pagan king. Well, we're going to have to talk about the meaning of that in the prophet, and that'll be the main subject of one of our later sessions this week. But I wanted to point out that the prophet also looks to the future, because one of the things we need to understand about the prophetic task and the role of the prophet, that the prophetic task is one of memory and hope. It's one in which past and future give meaning to the present. And one of the problems in the church, and one of the problems in biblical times, is the tendency to choose one or the other, the past or the future, to become so preoccupied with the past that you run the risk of what Jürgen Moltmann, a German theologian, called, you run the risk of becoming the fossil church. A fossil is a very faithful witness to the past, but it's incapable of becoming anything else. But if you're so preoccupied with the future that you lose touch with your roots in the past, then you run the risk of what Moltmann says is becoming the chameleon church. And that's a church that, having no roots and identity of its own, simply takes. And that's a great danger as well. The prophetic task is one in which the present finds its meaning by the intersection of identity in the past and a vision of the future. Hope, and that vision of the future is the vision of hope. Hope without memory is rootless, and remembrance without vision is dead. Now, I want to say a word now about the meaning of exile. We look at the external events, but we need to understand the meaning of this. We make a mistake if we think of the exile as simply a geographic change. It's not just a change of location of a small group of Hebrews. Far more important than the geography, and that's what we usually think of, far more important than the geography is that exile was a cultural, political, and religious upheaval. All of the values in each of those areas, culturally, politically, religiously, have been overturned or thrown into confusion. Their whole way of life is not going to be possible anymore. Even the royal officials are reduced to the life of peasants, staking a life or living out of the soil. Politically, the great kingship of David has come to an end. This is a kingship that the Judeans believed was promised by God forever. And there are no kings of David on the throne, and there will not be any longer. And religiously, the temple is in ruins. The very symbol of the whole religious life of Israel is shattered and destroyed, and the priesthood shipped off to Babylon with everyone else without a temple to worship in there. So everything that Israel really turned to for meaning and center and value in their life has been upset and overturned. The people trying to interpret that generally thought in one of three ways. And the prophet, 2 Isaiah, is concerned to refute two of those and to accept one of them. The first way of viewing this crisis by many in that time was to say that our God has been defeated by the superior Babylonian God. And you'll find 2 Isaiah and many of his oracles are saying, no, that's not what this means. In fact, over and over again, this prophet will say, no, indeed. Not only is this God not defeated by the superior gods of Babylon, this God is the only God there ever was in the first place. This prophet's going to be very radical on that. That's not the answer. Many believe that, well, if God hasn't been defeated, then God has simply forsaken Israel. We've been totally abandoned. And the prophet is going to be concerned to refute that as well and say, no, God still loves his people. God is still faithful. But love and faithfulness on the part of God does not remove the consequences from Israel's own sin. But God has not abandoned them. In fact, he is already active to deliver and restore Israel. That's part of the prophet's message to see this. And then the third interpretation, which is one that 2 Isaiah does accept, is that one of the meanings of the exile experience is that it constitutes God's own judgment on Israel's sinful behavior. God has not willfully forsaken his people, but the catastrophe which has befallen them is related to Israel's own arrogance, injustice, and unfaithfulness. And that in spite of God's love, God cannot remove the consequence of such sin from Israel. But while the prophet is concerned that all to whom the prophet speaks understand that the exile has had an element of judgment in it, the prophet is also concerned to move beyond judgment to hope. Final word of God for his people. So there's a sense in which we will want to talk about judgment as a continuing reality in the life of the church in the present. We are judged for our own sin. But that is not the final word for us either. And we'll turn to the prophet. I want to conclude today's session. I'm going to try to leave some time at the end of each session for questions and comments. I want to conclude today's session by suggesting to you that exile might be a very important image for the modern church. And if it is an important image for the modern church, then 2 Isaiah might be an important resource for the modern church in facing our own experience of exile. We don't often think of exile as an image that's very pertinent to our situation because we still think in those geographic terms. None of us expect to be carried off to a foreign land physically, I don't think. At least those would be rather wild nightmares. Most of us don't foresee that as any great difficulty facing us in our future. But when we begin to understand exile more broadly as upheavals in whole patterns of living and understanding and values and meaning, then we begin to come a little closer to something that we too might experience. Because I believe we are living in a time when many of our patterns of meaning and value and living are being radically overturned there is a sense in which in our future, both culturally and religiously, we may be living in a strange land compared to the way in which we now live. I've been greatly impressed with how many touches on that theme I've heard right here at Holden just in the last few days. The sermon last night at the Eucharist service talking about the report on the year 2000. If that doesn't sound like a strange land, I never heard a description of a strange land. That is not the land in which we are accustomed to living, and life in that kind of land is going to be a kind of an exile, where we are searching all over again for centers of value and meaning in our faith. Holden Village itself is something of a witness to the necessity to begin to consider alternative ways of living to the way in which we usually live in the outside world, so to speak. In a sense, Holden Village is one of what I would call an anticipatory community, anticipating the need to learn to live as exiles in a strange land, because there are some strange lands ahead of us. We don't like to consider that thing, because no one wishes to believe that catastrophe will befall them. Nevertheless, we do live in a time which carries with it the possibility of major upheaval. Various patterns of living and structures of meaning have been and will be overturned. At the worst, we live in a time which has the potential for major disasters like famine, nuclear war, major environmental damage. Those are some of the worst things that might happen, the sudden and cataclysmic changes. We live under the shadow of those possibilities. But even at best, we live in times of sharply changing economic patterns, political patterns, environmental patterns, all of which are going to affect our way of living in this period. There's several points of comparison that we might make with Israel's response to her impending exile in our own situation. I'll just make two or three. One is that in the period leading up to the exile, it was clear that Israel was running the potential for a great disaster. But no one wanted to acknowledge that or plan for it. So Jeremiah talked about those who cry peace, peace, and there is no peace. Well, there's a sense in which there are many in our own time which refuse to face even the possibility that we may have to deal with major and difficult upheaval in our way of life, even cataclysmic ones. Just the problem of nuclear proliferation and what nations and even groups achieve the capability of making an atomic bomb. That in itself is enough to scare the daylights out of you. Robert Heilbrunner, in his book, An Inquiry into the Human Prospect, which is over in the bookstore, by the way, a very provocative book, writes, "If then by the question, is there any hope for man, we ask whether it is possible to meet the challenges of the future without the payment of a fearful price, the answer must be, no, there is no such hope." Heilbrunner is one of our most respected economists and social philosophers. "If then by the question, is there any hope for man, we ask whether it is possible to meet the challenges of the future without the payment of a fearful price, then the answer must be, no, there is no such hope." Well, so many are refusing to acknowledge that we face these possibilities. And so instead say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. After all, talking about the need for austerity doesn't get you elected to office. You know, it's easy to get elected to office if you say things are going to look greater here. Now, a second point of comparison is that many in Judah facing their exile, instead of facing those possibilities for really catastrophic changes, instead went back the other way and hoped for the return of the golden age of David and Solomon. A really interesting dynamic. And I must say that I really find a lot of contemporary rhetoric speaking as if somehow there is a golden age of the American experience which can be repeated. And yet the world is changing. We're in a different scenario. It's difficult for Israel to acknowledge that because of forces largely beyond her control, Israel's golden age could not be repeated. And I think there's a sense in which that's true for us as well. We are not going to be in a world that's coming of age in many ways, particularly in which the third world is awakening and coming of age. We are not going to be the king of the mountain in the way we always have been. And we need to beware of those who promise that as a hope for the future. A third point of comparison is that we often respond, as Israel did, by saying, well, we can't see the way in which we can avoid these difficult situations, but God will take care of it. Even when the Babylonian army was encircling Jerusalem, there were those who were saying, God's simply waiting for the most dramatic moment. And so that God's not going to take us off the hook of our own dilemma either. We're going to have to wrestle with our own difficulties and challenges. And we need to be aware of those who keep speaking of America in terms that imply that we have some special relationship to God that is not true of all of God's children, the children of God's creation. Well, all of this is simply to say that it seems to me that the major question for the church in our time, if we are facing something of our own exile, the major question for us might be the question of the psalmist. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? Or to put it in another way, how can God's word be understood in a time when our accustomed way of life is coming apart? We live in a time already marked by some despair, I believe, at the changes that are occurring. I believe that the rampant individualism, this has been called the new generation, the widespread cynicism toward all institutions of leadership and authority, including our political institutions and the church, the growth of religious perspectives that separate the spiritual from the physical. I believe that many of those are evidences of despair at the situation that we're coming into in our world. How shall we as a community, as the church, sing the Lord's song in a strange land instead of everyone getting their own piece of the action while they're getting scared? And how do we bring hope to those who are already reacting in despairing ways? I think that's going to be the real question for us. And one of the reasons that I like the prophet 2nd Isaiah is I believe that's the question he faced and the one for which he gives us some resources. So in the days ahead, I want to raise up 5 themes out of the preaching of 2nd Isaiah, which did sing a Lord's song in a strange land. And attention to that song may give us some sense of what it means to be a community of hope in the kind of world we are living in and about living in the future. And at the same time we look at those themes in the prophet, I want at the end of each of those sessions to suggest a quality of the community of faith in the present that grows out of that theme, which might be a mark of the community that can sing the Lord's song in our own presence. I'll conclude there for today. We have a few minutes left for questions. I'll try to leave a little longer than this in most sessions, but there was a lot of ground to cover today. But I'm sure there's some questions or comments. Yes, Judy.
I was just thinking that maybe an important part of this is to be able to be building all the rooms that sense of community. that we do often feel isolated as we approach this kind of changing time. And to find the people around us who feel that way and want to work in that direction is really one of our tasks that we're being filled for here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true, because I think you'll see in the concert that a sense of corporateness and community is very important for nurturing hope. That hope is something that's very difficult to nurture if you feel totally isolated. But sometimes our sense of community need not always be physically present. Even having been here at Holden may give us a sense of community even when we feel isolated in our own particular setting. Yeah, absolutely, because that sense, any sense of corporate community, if it's not centered on God, is without that center, it will not long be a community. That's the focus for any kind of community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't find any better image for that than the body of Christ, which is both focused and corporate. It's focused in God and Christ, and yet it requires the whole body to be the fullest expression of that. Well, that's why I say that if you may find yourself feeling isolated in some particular setting, but to understand yourself as part of a wider community centered on God is a resource for those moments of isolation. When we're without that focus in God and that sense of community with the wider fellowship of the community of faith, that's the moment that we're most vulnerable to despair and resignation.
Some people, I think, have the idea that John doesn't first.
Yes, and the way I would want to talk about that is that we really need, particularly in the American church, to face the theme of judgment. That judgment is a part of the biblical message, and judgment, the God who judges is the same God who delivers and creates.
Well, it really some people say, God loves you, and that's all that you do. And some faith, that God might not want to punish you, and that's faith.
Yeah, I would have to have room in my theology for a God who also holds us accountable for the consequences of our sin. But hope without a sense of our judgment for sin runs very close to what Bonhoeffer called cheap grace. And that kind of cheap grace is not going to be helpful to us as a church in this kind of day, I don't believe. I think there's a sense in which we often want resurrection without crucifixion. We want wisdom without folly. We want life without death. But it seems to me biblical theology is constantly emphasizing that hope and new life and forgiveness all lies on the other side of our acknowledgement of our own sin and need for repentance. And unless we're willing to acknowledge that, we can't really lay claim to the grace that is ours. That message is very strong in this prophet. He recasts them in new ways. He sees them with new eyes and hears them with new ears. And I think that's sometimes what we need to do. It's not so much that we need whole new resources, because I think the biblical tradition is our fundamental resource for the community of faith. But we desperately need to see those with new ears and see them with new eyes and hear them with new ears. See them with new ears. we desperately need that kind of revisioning process. And the prophet, I think, will help us on that, because what he does with his own tradition can be a model for what we do with our biblical traditions, the ability to see them in new, be confronted by them in new ways that we perhaps have not been confronted by them before. The one theme in the prophet that seems somewhat new in the biblical material to me is the theme of the suffering servant. But of course, for us then, that isn't a new theme. That's there in the prophet as part of our historic tradition, the weakness